I'll repeat my question from the other side of the tape, which was, what were some of the issues that you dealt with as a member of the Chicago School Board from 1956 to 61?
I suppose one issue that occurs to me almost automatically was the issue of improving the quality of the school program. I might point out to you that the Chicago school system, or the Board of Education, being reorganized as a result of a scandal which had taken place in the Chicago schools, a scandal of such vast proportion that the accreditation of the Chicago high schools was threatened. Because of that threat, it was City Hall then had to, and that I think was under Mayor Kelly, City Hall had to capitulate, because the parents were furious about the possibility of their student, of their, about the possibility, maybe I think Washington was it, about the possibility of their youngsters not being able to enter college.
What was the scandal before we go?
Well, the scandal was that the president of the school board sort of ran it as something of a kingdom. There was a question of integrity of the school, of the school system, and poor policies in administering the schools. In other words, the schools had developed a very, very bad reputation in sense of, from the standpoint of public confidence. In order to correct the situation, the citizenry, when I say citizenry, the leading citizens worked out an arrangement, and I'm somewhat uncertain whether it later was finally enacted into law, under which the mayor agreed that whenever a vacancy occurred on the school board, that a citizens commission, which was set up, consisted of representatives of the various professional societies, like the Chicago Medical Society, Chicago Bar Association, the unions, the various civic groups, I forget the total size of the commission, that for every vacancy on the school board, they would nominate three individuals, and the mayor would appoint one out of those three. And the mayor functioned on that basis, and that was, and I was not, a nominee of that commission, and was ultimately appointed to the board. Well, that meant what we wanted to do with, we were particularly concerned with raising the quality of the school system. I might say, by the way, that Sergeant Shriver, the brother-in-law of President Kennedy, was president, although he became president of the Board of Education. And so, and we brought in a very dynamic superintendent, Dr. Willis, W-I-L-L-I-S, as superintendent of schools, and a great deal was done then about raising the quality of the school program. That was an issue which we were particularly concerned with. We were concerned about the personnel in the system, what could be done to increase raise the standard of morale, and also the financing of the schools was another problem. And we already saw the seeds. In fact, I think I very early in my tenure on the board recognized this business of some of our schools deteriorating because of the racial situation. That was already developing, how to deal with the problem. For example, our very fine high school called the Hyde Park High School, we had many prominent graduates that, with the changing neighborhood pattern, with the racial makeup of the city, that school, then we could see it was deteriorating very, very badly. So we could see that was another problem we were dealing with. So that the whole thrust of the Board of Education was to eliminate any doubt as to the integrity of the board and the school administration, and to just raise the total quality of the school, of the school system. Remember, Chicago is represents a vast system. Of course, not as large, obviously, as New York, but I think even the time I was serving, I think we had about 500,000 youngsters in the Chicago.
Were your children part of the Chicago school system at this time?
My younger son stayed in. He was intermittently, but he finally did. Both of them started out in the elementary school. My oldest son because apparently the elementary school, which I felt was a very good school, but he needed something more in the way of discipline, he transferred to what the University of Chicago calls the laboratory school. I suppose it corresponds to the fourth school here at the University of Pittsburgh. That's far more, I would say, prestigious. And he went to the University of Chicago Laboratory School, and he graduated from the University of Chicago Laboratory School. My youngest son was in the public school for one time. We transferred him to one of the private schools, again, because we felt he needed something like that. But lo and behold, later he went to Hyde Park High School, and he did graduate from Hyde Park High School. I might say my being on the Board of Education made it somewhat difficult for him when he was in Hyde Park High School. Not that he was subject to any persecution or whatnot, but because I was such an active member of the board, that we very frequently encountered situations where the teacher would say, "Well, Mark, we see that your father has said thus and thus about the schools," and he found himself in a somewhat awkward position because I was considered one of the activists on the Board of Education. By the way, I happen to have been a very strong proponent, long before it's come out now, about merit pay for teachers, and did a great deal of public speaking in connection with the schools. In fact, I was invited to many schools, and I spoke. And interesting enough, although, of course, the Chicago Teachers Union did not, like so many unions in the unions of teachers, did not look with favor upon the business of merit pay. I was considered fully acceptable as an individual to the Chicago Teachers Union, and they were very friendly to me.
Were there a lot of black students in the Hyde Park school system?
Yes, in the Hyde Park school, high school, yes. And seeing we could see that problem developing, I tried to, and I think, I'm not saying I'm so far ahead of my day, but it's happened in other situations. Sometimes I could see something, but really, you're not very effective unless you can sell your idea, and I wasn't effective in selling my idea. I remember proposing to the president of the board that we have a special committee, but functioning quietly to start dealing with this racial situation. But I didn't get far with Mr. Shriver on that.
What was the racial situation in Chicago at the time?
I forget the percentages, but we could see, as you, perhaps more so than you have in Pittsburgh, well, I guess I have someone in Pittsburgh. See, we had whole areas of the city where blacks tended to be concentrated, or where the school boundaries, you see, put many blacks into the schools, and especially on the so-called South Side, and that's where we lived. That presented a very difficult situation. There were other areas where you didn't have the problem. Like the Northwest was, say, a big Jewish area, and you didn't have the problem. But let me also point out that because Chicago is strongly ethnic in character, which you can say that Pittsburgh, but we felt it much more in Chicago, that you did have ethnic problems. It wasn't, we had racial problems, because I could see those developing. But I know cases that were brought to my attention personally. There were ethnic problems where, as we have to be frank about it, that we must recognize more and more that different ethnic groups don't love each other, aside from any racial problems. And that very, very frequently, for example, or at least, well, maybe very frequently, maybe I'm exaggerating, but enough times to impress upon me the fact that there is certain antagonism, whether it's racial, whether it's religious bias, or whether it's a certain bias between different ethnic groups, that itself sometimes presented a problem.
How do these manifest themselves within the school system?
Sometimes, particularly in terms of how youngsters related to each other, if you got at something like the high school level.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I remember, I think it was some relatives, my wife brought to my attention the fact that a youngster, and it wasn't a case of intellectual ability, was having difficulty in relating to some of her fellow students in a particular school. And there were these antagonisms, because Chicago, as I say, the ethnic groups are very much compartmentalized. In many respects, certainly at that time, very self-sufficient. If you went into a Greek neighborhood, that was very self-sufficient. Lithuanian was absolutely kept with its own hospitals, its own, of course, naturally, churches and whatnot. So that if you got yourself into a school situation where if you drew the school boundaries, you see, and you cut across there, then you could have difficulty.
Was your wife involved in the school system at all?
No, my...
Or as an active parent?
She might. I'm trying to recall whether she was active at all in the parent teachers association. I did have this phenomenon that my wife was not very active in civic affairs. She was much more active in the temple, this KAM temple. That was the temple from which Rabbi Freehorf came. And
was he there at the time you were
no,
there?
No, he already left, and his successor, Jacob Weinstein, was then the rabbi of the temple. And that, by the way, was a very, very strong group of people. Most of them, I guess, had some affiliation, whether they were with the university or alumni of the university. This was quite a cohesive group. And I think, so far as any outside activities, my wife was much more involved in that than in civic activities. She did not share with me, you might say, very much participation in civic matters.
In 1962, you were involved with the Brookings Institute. Can you give us a little background about what the Brookings Institute is and how you become a participant?
Let's see. I had then left the Signode Corporation, and I had joined the University of Pittsburgh in 1961. Brookings Institution, is a research organization. There are two big research organizations, private research organizations, in Washington at the present time. Brookings Institution, which you might say, if I can put it that way, has a more liberal quality to it, but very frequently you'll hear on television a reference to another institution called American Enterprise Institute. Brookings is endowed heavily. Many officials who've been prominent in the government, particularly those who have a liberal tendency, like Schulze, had been director of the budget, and he was just on Meet the Press Sunday. Many of them will, once they're through with the government, or maybe sometimes before they enter government, especially in the field of economics, but also political science, they will be affiliated with Brookings. Brookings does a great deal of research. By the way, Alice Rivlin, who of course this isn't in your sphere, but who really established the Congressional Budget Office and put it on a plane of tremendous stature. Alice Rivlin came from Brookings Institution and then went back to it when she decided she didn't want to continue any longer as head director of this Congressional Budget Office. She went back there. So Brookings is an endowed research organization with dealing with problems of economics, particularly so far as government is concerned, with the structure of government, with the policies of government, and has an international reputation. My role there was in connection with a study which Brookings made of the personnel system. They were retained by the then mayor of New York. I don't know whether Wagner was in there at that time, but whoever the mayor was, to, let's see, who was the chap who was so, my sister found him so photogenic, so handsome, I forget. His politics or his policy didn't mean too much because he's such a handsome fellow. My sister was an avid supporter of his. I forget, Lindsay, wasn't that
Mayor
Lindsay?
She had good taste.
Yeah. He was very, no question about it being handsome. Brookings was retained to make a study of the personnel system of New York, and because of the interdependence between personnel and budgeting, and I having some status as in the budgeting field, I was retained to study their budgeting system insofar as it impacted upon the way in which their personnel was administered. And the book was then published, and I have, I guess my report is included as one of them.
Is this what brought you to Brookings, or were you there before?
No, I had not been there before. I was, somebody recommended me to Brookings as an individual who might make this study for them. My total affiliation with Brookings was in connection with this personnel study, which did extend over a period of some months and involved a great deal of work studying the government of the city of New York. Because I, as an old New Yorker, it was easier for me to, in a sense, adjust myself to the city of New York, and I wrote a report which was then included in the total volume which was presented, and which indicated to what extent their budget system was interfering, if you will, with a good personnel system in New York.
At the same time, you were, as you've mentioned, professor at the University of Pittsburgh.
That's right.
How did you get here, and which department were you in?
Well, I had been working for Signo from, let's see, that was 47, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
47 to 61. And you therefore have to understand what motivated me to accept this professorship. Of course, while working for Signo, I was extremely active in public affairs. Because even when I was director of finance in the state of Illinois, it was on the basis of Signo giving me a part-time leave, and Signo continuing my salary as the chief financial officer, because the salary, well, just as you read now about public officials who are leaving, let us say, President Reagan's administration, the salary in the public service is very small compared with what you get if you have a responsible position in the private sector. So I could not afford to give up my position for Signo, and so even when I served as director of finance, Signo continued my salary, and the pittance which I received from the state, this was small, darn small amount compared with what Signo paid me, I turned over to Signo, and that was the understanding. So let me point out then, so while I was with Signo, I was very active. I was, after all, I was president of the Housing Planning Council. I was president of the Immigrant Service League. I was then director of finance of Illinois, and I found that that became a very important part my total interest, my total life. And as important as being the chief financial officer and also being engaged in legal matters for the Signal Corporation, that by itself, I found, would not satisfy me. Once, particularly, I had this background in the public service, and public affairs fascinate me. And I was reaching a point where that was very difficult, because although the corporation wanted somebody to be active in public affairs, I don't think they were overly enthusiastic when I started making the headlines. you see the limits as to enthusiasm, and you know, in the corporate sphere, let us say, that's one thing I found about human nature. It's the same whether you're in the military, whether you're in the corporation, whether you're in academic work, where jealousy, rivalry starts setting in. And it seems strange, after all, here I certainly was not a wealthy person, but here I was being head of various civic organizations, and somebody references to me in the public press. I realized I was getting myself into a difficult situation, and the corporation had started balking a little as to the amount of time I was spending, even though originally they thought it was a wonderful thing to have for the corporation. As you know, many corporations in Pittsburgh do the same thing. They elect a vice president. In some instances, there's nothing but public affairs.
That indirectly keeps them in the public eye also.
Of course, it's a question of building an institutional image, that's it.
Right.
But, and to that extent, maybe my Jewishness didn't help me. Don't forget, I was one of the few corporate officers at that time, it doesn't apply so much now, to a lesser extent applies, was Jewish. Very, very, very unusual at that time for a Jew to be a corporate officer. Of a non-Jewish corporation.
Was this ever an issue?
No, it never came up. In fact, when I was being recruited for it, it was rather interesting. Signal had a system of psychological evaluations, and I must say that always left me with it. The psychological evaluations, I'm no great enthusiast, but I was then called in by the psychological consultant, the head of the firm, and he put me through the intelligence test, and just towards the tail end, he said, and he was a PhD, so that helped me a little, so he said, Dr. Poise, what is your religion? I said, here's where the thing explodes, and I said, Jewish, and then he gave me that same old spiel. Well, of course, I know some very fine people who are Jewish.
Some of my best friends.
That same old, and I said, well, there it goes. I'm not, even though I was way at the top. But lo and behold, I was retained, which was somewhat, I think, particularly because of my wartime service.
It wasn't that you were the token Jew.
No. Because of my wartime service, the president of the company had gone down and interviewed the people in the Coast Guard to see about me, and that helped me immeasurably. Well, anyhow, I had reached a point then. I almost had to make a choice. But I stayed with Signal to give up many of those activities, and it was getting very uncomfortable. And I couldn't satisfy myself that it would be intellectually satisfying to focus upon Signal. So I put feelers out, and by coincidence, I hadn't sent anything to Stone, Donald C. Stone, who founded the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. You've been, perhaps you know, it's a newspaper, there's been a big ruckus about it as to what to do about it. Well, lo and behold, I had already been offered, I think, was I supposed to be deputy superintendent of schools of the city of New York? Thank God I didn't take that, because later on they bounced the superintendent. I would have been bounced with him. And so Stone wrote me and said, look, you have an unusual background. You've been both in the private sector, you've been in the public sector, you've been in the military, and here our school is getting underway, and we'd like to have a person with that mix. And Litchfield, you see, knew me, because I used to teach some lectured Cornell University in the school of which Litchfield was the dean, the school of There they combined business and public affairs, and I would lecture at that school. So he said, what about considering an appointment to the University of Pittsburgh? But at least come down, let us talk about it. And so they asked what they very freaking do, would I give a series of lectures or what? So I gave a series of lectures here and came down.
On what subject?
Well, I spoke in, see, public administration, government, in particular governmental financial management. And then they finally, you know, in terms of the haggling, they made an offer which was ultimately, not initially, but ultimately so attractive. It's not too frequently that you can get to be a full professorship with tenure right off the bat.
Wow.
and that's what they negotiated. The salary, of course, was the differential. In fact, some members of the Signal Board thought I was absolutely crazy. Maybe I was, but the differential was so vast, you know, between what you get, even in those days, as a corporate financial officer with your fringe benefit, with your bonuses, and with your stock option plans. So I decided, well, would I be happier here? And so on that basis, I came, and it was to be professor of public administration in the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. And because they had different programs there, one of which was public administration as such, one was economic and social development, I was to head up the public administration program.
How did your family feel about this move?
It had a, and the longest discussion is so candid, it had a very advert, I guess my wife went along, but because her affiliation, and it may seem, you know, small item, with this KAM Temple group, that had become such a part of her life, it was understandable, it was a very stimulating group.
Talk a little bit about that, since we are doing oral history for a Jewish organization.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about
it. Well, I think my wife's case illustrated very much how, let's say, a woman could be a man too, but in her, let's say in this case, take her, we're talking with her as a woman, how much a particular Jewish organization, in this case, a temple, and even though she was not really religious, but this temple had become so much to her because she was a rather withdrawn person, quite very quiet, not particularly assertive, and she derived a great deal of happiness out of the affiliation with KAM. It was a very interesting group. With a lot of cultural activity, apparently the rapport amongst them was very great, and you had this unusual mix of people from the university, from the professions, whether the lawyers, doctors, and people tied up with the university, people of the, sort of a more liberal tendency. That became a very vital part of her life, a very vital part of her life. I realized it more, you know, once we moved here. Now, even I had some difficulty adjusting, but in my case, it was adjusting to the university as such. When I came, my initial feeling was, I wasn't too happy when I first came here. But then, you see, I had many other things. With consulting and whatnot, I wasn't even so dependent upon the university for stimulation and recognition. And I must say my wife was never happy in Pittsburgh. Our reception in Pittsburgh was unfortunate. And I remember she called up, and I say this not criticizing Rhoda Shulman at the present time, but certainly the whole administration has changed. But because we were coming from KAM, which was the Reform Temple, but again, a Reform Temple that was taking more of the liturgy. They were taking, as you know, some of the Reformed temples are becoming more ritualistic. And I remember her calling the executive director and being told, he wondered, you know, and especially when he, I guess he heard we came from KM, whether we would find at that, it was such, so strange, and Officer Rota would be just delighted to get an additional member. I know they're very cordial when I go over there to a service occasionally. So the executive director, unfortunately, was very aloof about it. So then I tried another temple. I might as well mention it, Temple Sinai, because I had a friend in New York who knew the then rabbi of Temple Sinai. And I went there, the fellow seemed to be all right. I remember them applying for membership and then receiving a note which just shocked me. And I am sure it's nothing which is done now, but as long as you want history, it'll give you history. I received a note that the membership committee, first of all, that puzzled me too. After all, if it's a shul, it's a shul.